the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
And I wish to thank the listeners who support this program, like Russ Archibald all the way in Hawaii, Jeffrey Adair, Janet Price, Michael Gill. We'll be announcing a new program here for support of the Peter B. Collins Show in the next week or so. I thank you all for supporting this program and sharing it widely with your friends and loved ones. Before the end of this podcast, Gary Chu, the official film reviewer of the Peter B. Collins Show, will check in and recommend not one, but four films for your holiday consumption. But first, let's meet a candidate for President of the United States.
Presidential elections are planned distractions to divert attention from the action behind the scenes. Like a game of chess when the house is a mess, or a petty money squabble when your marriage is in trouble, or a football game when there's rioting in the streets. It's just another movie, another song and dance, another poor sucker who never had a chance.
That's a musical commentary from the mid-1980s, Timbuk 3, responding to the campaign of Ronald Reagan for re-election back in 1984. Well, we've got a very difficult set of choices confronting us in the coming year. Clearly for progressives, aside from some of Ron Paul's foreign policy positions, there is nobody that progressives could lean to in the Republican Party. And the Obama team has done an excellent job of precluding any meaningful challenge from inside the Democratic Party and the left wing of the party. Now, an update. My friend Aldous Tyler, who we had on the program a few months back, he's from Madison, Wisconsin. He had thrown his hat into the ring and gotten on the ballot in New Hampshire. But he recently rolled up his campaign and is throwing his support to Darcy Richards, an independent man from Florida, who has gained ballot access in a number of states. And Aldous always said that it wasn't about him, it was about the message, and he's found a standard bearer who can carry on his fight. Joining us today is a candidate for the Green Party nomination for president next year, Dr. Jill Stein. She is a mother, a housewife, a medical doctor, a longtime teacher of internal medicine, and a pioneering environmental health advocate. Dr. Stein, thanks for joining us today on the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thank you so much, Peter. It's great to be with you.
Now, why the hell would you want to be president?
Well, I guess, you know, we got a fight on our hands. We got a fight to save jobs, to afford health care, to put our kids through school without them coming out indentured servants, to stop the war for empire that's devouring our national budget from within, to protect our civil liberties, you know, and every one of us is on the line. You know, I learned a long time ago as a, you know, as a medical professional, basically, that healthcare was falling apart. And I tried to work on healthcare and basically found you're not going to fix healthcare while the system is designed to serve health insurance executives and pharmaceutical companies. You know, we've really got to fix the broken political system if we're going to fix anything that's broken.
Well, tell me three reasons why, in particular, registered Democrats in their primary elections this year should cross over and vote for Jill Stein if she becomes the Green Party nominee?
Let me count the ways, you know. I mean, it's hard to find an area in which progressives and people of conscience and community-supporting good-hearted citizens, you know, haven't been betrayed by Barack Obama. I mean, you can start with the war. Yeah, we've come out of Iraq, but that was a timetable set by George Bush. And we're leaving 15,000, you know, Americans there, and many of them security defense contractors, and we're moving many more troops just right over the border into Kuwait. We've opened up a whole new front in the war for oil in Central Africa. We've started drone wars all over the place. You know, this has not been a peace president by any means. Guantanamo is open, alive and well, and our civil liberties are more endangered than they have ever been under George Bush with the passage of this new National Defense Authorization Act that basically does away with our right to a trial by jury, makes it possible for the president to basically throw you in the clinker because he suspects you may be an enemy of the state, however he cares to define that.
Dr. Stein, let's focus on that a moment, because I've been hammering away trying to raise awareness of the very, very evil, draconian language in this National Defense Authorization Act. And it's been a process of great confusion, because there are three different clauses in the NDAA that define covered persons who could be held at a military base indefinitely without charge or trial. And the language conflicts in those three different clauses, leaving us uncertain. And even my mostly Republican but nominally Democrat senator from California, Dianne Feinstein, has recognized the constitutional violation here and has proposed a bill to clarify that American citizens still have their constitutional rights. And what is really breathtaking is if we start with the first insult from President Obama, which was, "I'm looking forward, not backward," which meant that there would be no accountability for crimes that occurred in the Bush era, whether they were in the financial sector on Wall Street or in the public sector related to eavesdropping, wiretapping, which are clear violations of the Fourth Amendment, and the whole mess of the Patriot Act and the other incursions on the rights that we all had prior to 9/11. And there have been many steps in between, but to me, the president's insistence to Senator Levin that he remove the language coming out of committee with the National Defense Authorization Act that clearly excluded American citizens in the United States from its sweep, its dragnet, the president said, take that out. The White House instructed Carl Levin to do that. Now, number one, I think it's way out of line for the White House to even attempt that. And why would Senator Levin submit? These really are indications of not only a serious contempt for the American people, but the sense that the expansion of presidential power is something that should occur. It's just something that everybody should support.
You've said it very well. And, you know, I think had George Bush done this, progressives would have been absolutely up in arms and unstoppable, you know, until this was, you know, vetoed by the president or voted down by our congressmen and women. It's, you know, it's really a sign of how far the Democratic Party has been compromised and has really muzzled and neutered, politically neutered the political community, the progressive community, so that it really has no voice at all. Constitutional scholars like Gren Greenwald, you know, have been very clear in their analysis of this bill that it really does, you know, allow the president to do whatever he wants with American citizens. And yes, there is ambiguous language, but my understanding, even reading Levin's defense of the bill, you know, it was an extremely weak defense, and all he could come up with was that it did not require that American citizens be treated, you know, as foreign terrorists and subject to basically military tribunals and locked away indefinitely without charge and without the right to a trial. It doesn't insist that Americans be treated that way, but it allows them to be treated that way. And as far as I can tell, based on Levin's defense, it doesn't get any better than that. It's merely their best defense for it was that it did not
require.
It did not lock Americans into that treatment, but it allows for it, which means that the president has absolute authority to basically function like a dictator and throw thousands of people into jail like the Egyptian, democracy advocates have been treated for decades. This is a very dangerous move, and as you point out, especially in the context of the other violations against our civil liberties, including the Patriot Act's violation of our rights to privacy and protection against unreasonable search and seizure. You add to that, this blurring of the line between military and security. And that is police security forces, and the Military Defense Authorization Act does that as well in allowing the military to be used on American soil against U.S. citizens. Add to that, this militarization that's taken place with the funneling of basically military hardware and techniques to police forces, and as we've seen in the attacks, the very brutal attacks against the Occupy encampments around the country, you have this lethal combination of military force with a suspension of our constitutional rights. That is a setup for a disaster, and the road is paved here towards the military state. This is not something that anyone can afford to sit back on as our constitutional rights are basically shredded, especially those who have ever entertained the idea of standing up and protesting and potentially committing civil disobedience. And as our economy continues to go down the tubes, there is more and more reason for us, to be out there protesting and seeking redress, and our ability to do that has just been essentially abolished.
Dr. Stein, if you care to say, did you vote for Barack Obama for president?
I did not. I was not persuaded by the rhetoric, but then I'm someone who I spend an awful lot of time, delving into the politics beneath the surface, and it was pretty clear to me that his language was just too ambiguous and his record was far too centrist for me to trust what he was saying. For a long time, I have been working to build an alternative political party that is not hijacked by the power of big money, and it only took, a day or two after Barack Obama was elected to see where his priorities really were, and that was with Wall Street, as we saw from his very first acts, which were to bring Larry Summers, back into the White House and to fill the White House with Goldman Sachs graduates. And we've seen really from the get-go where his priorities lie.
Well, Dr. Stein, I did vote for President Obama, for Senator Obama for president. And I felt I had appropriately lowered my expectations. Like you, I heard him give speeches where people could project their own issues and positions onto the language that he was presenting. And you could say, oh, yeah, he agrees with me. He supports my position. But my minimalist approach was that he would return us to constitutional rule. And that his background as an attorney and a guy who instructed at the college level in constitutional law would lead him to rein in the Patriot Act instead of renewing it for 4 years by auto pen from Europe without any amendments whatsoever, despite the clear admissions from the FBI itself and its inspector general that tens of thousands of abuses of national security letters have occurred since the Patriot Act was passed. And likewise, I consider his effort to close Guantanamo a good intention, but he was brushed back not only by Republicans, but by Senate Leader Harry Reid and other members of his own party. And they have joined forces with the Republicans to lock into law. That's the other part of this National Defense Authorization Act that forces the president to continue military tribunals, which I call kangaroo courts. And while the language doesn't explicitly say he's got to keep Guantanamo open, by preventing any of these suspects from being brought to American soil and by committing them to the custody of the military, that's implicit. So my question, and you may not have a clear answer, but I've got to ask it anyway, is was Obama the candidate simply a con man and I was sucked into it, Or did he mean those things? And after he got elected, something changed. They got to him. They threatened him when he was briefed into black programs and all the black world of our covert operations. He said, oops, I can't do what I said I would have done as candidate.
That's a very good question, and I'll answer it in two ways. You know, one is to sort of say that, you know, in my opinion, you know, Barack Obama is a bit of a black box. You know, he's a mystery, and we can come up with all kinds of hypotheticals. But even without knowing what's inside the box, we know what comes out of the box. And what comes out of the box, you know, has been very harmful to the cause of justice and democracy and an equitable economy that works for people and peace and all that, you know. So I sort of feel like we don't, as interesting as it is, we actually don't need to know the answer to that question, you know, in order to decide what to do about it. You know, and the other thing I would say is that, you know, if you actually look at his record closely, that he was always kind of a centrist, and, you know, he would make some statements, but he didn't actually really push the envelope in a progressive direction. I believe when he came to Congress, you know, that the people that he surrounded himself with, you know, were not real progressives in Congress, that this just wasn't a person who, you know, was a barnstorming, you know, rabble-rousing progressive from the get-go.
Yeah.
So who knows, you know, but I think the way forward is very clear. And the fact that progressive Democrats have not been able to mount a challenge within the Democratic Party, to me, just speaks volumes about the Democratic Party really being moribund, that it is now a place where lobbyists and big money special interests rule the day, so mm-hmm. that even while there are some good rank-and-file people there, they just, you know, are so against the grain that they cannot speak out, and that, you know, basically the Republican agenda rules the day, even from inside the Democratic Party.
Let's find out a little bit more about you, Jill Stein. I have a bio here. You grew up in Highland Park, north of Chicago, just up the road from Northwestern, where I went to school. You graduated from Harvard College in 73 and then the medical school at Harvard in 1979. You have two grown children and a husband who's a doctor. So tell us what informs your candidacy. What is it in your background that has led you to put yourself forward open up your private life to exploration like Herman Cain's, open you up to all kinds of attacks from people who haven't even met you and don't have any idea what you're truly like? So tell us what propels you into this arena, Dr. Jill Stein.
Well, first, you know, I've been in this arena quite some time. I've been active in the world of policy for about 20 years and running political campaigns as a candidate for the past 10 years. So, you know, it's not as though this is a new direction. I was called into this race. I have been active really at the state and local level, have never been interested in running in national politics before because I've been part of a grassroots effort building from the bottom up. But I really became convinced that we needed to mount a progressive challenge to Barack Obama and the Democratic Party this past spring as the debt ceiling debacle was unfolding and the president was suggesting that we could solve our debt problems by putting Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid on the chopping block. I mean, that coming after his betrayals on the Keystone Pipeline, the backpedaling on ozone protections, the bailouts, and the unbelievable, you know, I mean, first it was $700 billion, but now we've learned it's more like $7 trillion or maybe more than that that's been basically handed out to Wall Street.
Well, let me add to that,
this was enough.
The total amount in bailouts exceeds $14 trillion, and that's mm-hmm. based on two very credible sources. Nomi Prinz is an author who worked on Wall Street, was a vice president at one of the big investment banks there, and also William Black, who was a savings and loan regulator and helped lock up Charlie Keating and 1,000 other thieves in the 1980s. And he pegs it at 14 to 17 trillion. And that number includes actual cash that was loaned to financial institutions and the assumption of liabilities. And that, of course, that 14 trillion figure could be a very low estimate, because nobody truly knows how much those mortgage-backed securities and the bad bets that were placed against them will truly cost us in the end.
That's a very good point, and I would agree with you that those are two really terrific sources. And, you know, the estimates are all over the map. You know, I've seen as high as $29 trillion. So, you know, I think on that account also, $14 trillion is about a nice midpoint among the range of estimates. So I'd be happy to settle on that figure.
Well, and I would just point out that here we are 3 years down the road from the epicenter, if you will, of the meltdown, and we still don't know. And Ben Bernanke has been out there, you know, Obama reappointed him. He had a golden opportunity to change horses there and really signal to progressives like us that he wasn't going to stick with the old gang and the Wall Street apologists. And so he kept Bernanke on, and Bernanke's been going out telling people that the TARP, the $750 billion, is the beginning and the end of bailouts. He has never honestly disclosed the true role of the Fed in propping up its friends in the financial sector.
Exactly, and it's only because of the FOIAs that were filed by various organizations, including the newspaper in New York. Only on that account, you know, do we have some idea of actually how much money the Fed did hand out. And as you're pointing out, it's not only that we don't know how much went out, it's also that the problem just has not been fixed. And it's no surprise, given who's running the show, Barack Obama's appointments, with the likes of Jeffrey Immelt heading the Jobs Commission and Tim Geithner in charge of Treasury, Tim Geithner, who managed not to notice what was going on for years as the head of the New York Fed. You know, it's no surprise that not only is there not disclosure, but, you know, there's no remedy on the horizon here, both by way of the abuses of the big banks, the size of the big banks, which have only gotten bigger and continue to be all the more too big to fail. You know, the firewall between investment banking and commercial banking is still not there. We need to bring back Glass-Steagall. The fixes, you know, have not been done. And, you know, we see once again that Barack Obama and the Democratic Party, like the Republican Party, serving their corporate campaign sponsors. So, again, to my mind, this is a reason why we really need a systemic fix here. It's not simply about bringing in someone with a nice smile and with a good oratory skills. You know, we really need a fundamental fix here that puts our democracy back on track, that reins in corporations, gets them out of government, gets big money out of the business of running our politics, and then starts to fix the problems, which are eminently fixable. It's not rocket science. This is all a question of whether we have a democracy that's actually serving everyday people, or whether we continue to have a government of, by, and for the financial elite.
Dr. Stein, what do you make of the Occupy movement? And how do you feel, given their stance, that at least at this point, the clear message is that they do not want to align with either of the political parties? They don't want to be co-opted into the Democratic Party the way some people see the Tea Party has been on the Republican side. I don't share that notion, because the Tea Party is a concoction, and the Republican embrace of it is their own business and an expedient approach, but it doesn't really have the same impact, in my view. Occupy, to me, is a very broad expression of discontent in the United States, and that expression is focused around the financial inequities, both income and wealth, the government being run more and more by corporate interests, and Citizens United, I think, helped a lot of people see that much more clearly. The problem is that Occupy doesn't have an explicit political agenda, a list of demands or a manifesto that all the groups have agreed upon. So how do you see aligning with Occupy in a way that can fuel activity in the political sector?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question, and it's a work in progress, as the entire Occupy movement is very much a work in progress. And, you know, I have to say that from the get-go, the chemistry has been really good between my campaign and the Occupy movements. And I have visited many of them, maybe about a dozen so far around the country. And from the very start, you know, there's been great mutual appreciation and support. We've been very careful not to approach the Occupy in a predatory fashion, and I think they're absolutely right to be very suspicious of traditional politics and to be very guarded against it and its designs on co-opting, misleading, and abusing Occupy in the same way that corporate politics misuses and abuses voters and citizens of all stripes. So I think their suspicions are well informed, and in my experience, the occupiers have been delighted to learn that there is another kind of politics, a kind of non-corporate, alternative, grassroots, people-powered politics, and they have been really excited about it. So in Boston, some of the occupiers I've talked to have got really excited about the idea of their actually holding their own debates and making the threshold for requirement not that you have raised however many millions of dollars, but rather that you have declined any money from corporate America and from lobbyists, that they, you know, basically embrace elections, not hold them at arm's length, but really go headlong into the electoral arena and make it their own, you know, to essentially occupy it. And, you know, I have found that they are very interested in exploring the electoral arena. I think things have been, you know, quite chaotic in the Occupy movement because they've been under assault, they've been under attack, and they've had to pack up and move. So, you know, in many, I dare say most Occupy sites have been evicted. So they've had to relocate. That's always assuming and difficult to do. But as the dust settles, I think they are beginning to explore other options, and electoral politics is one of them.
The mayor of Oakland inadvertently disclosed that she was on a conference call with 18 other municipal leaders, coordinated by a murky police group with ties to the Department of Homeland Security. And as we have seen, pepper spray used gratuitously, first in New York, University of California, Davis, and the woman in Seattle who 85 mm-hmm. plus years old, and of course some of the brutal behavior, specifically in Oakland, where two war veterans, one from Iraq and I believe one from Afghanistan, mm-hmm. Were injured in unnecessary police-instigated violence. So when you look at that and tie it together with the civil liberties issues we discussed earlier, Dr. Stein, do we have a police state developing in this country, and how do we control that? How do we roll it back? Is it possible, or is this a train that is very hard to stop?
I would agree. That train has left the station, you know, this train that has basically abused our civil liberties, that is actively violating our constitutional rights, and certainly the Occupy sites are a very troubling, you know, sign of the times, that their rights to speak freely, to petition government for redress, and to be informed by a free press, all three aspects of the First Amendment are under attack in the assault on Occupy. And I would just refer people to a website that our campaign established called First Amendment Pledge, firstamendmentpledge.org, which is essentially a petition campaign that pledges resistance to this trend towards a police state, and it pledges non-cooperation with the parties who are involved in their efforts to both repress our civil liberties and in any elections upcoming, that we will not give our votes to any elected officials who've been a party to this oppression. And you are right in also pointing out that this does not stop at the local level, that there are very disturbing signs here that point directly to the White House, in that several federal agencies have been implicated, both Homeland Security and the FBI. And of course, this is nothing new for the FBI. Their COINTEL program for, you know, for decades has been all about violating civil liberties and civil rights and harassing advocates for peace and justice and civil rights and so on.
Well, and so, I wish Clint Eastwood's recent film about J. Edgar Hoover had focused more on COINTELPRO and the constitutional abuses than on whether he had a male lover and liked to wear dresses. But that's Clint Eastwood's prerogative as a director. Dr. Stein, one of the other things that is surfacing out of the Occupy movement is the exploitation of dissension or disagreement over tactics. And a couple of weeks ago, Occupy shut down the Port of Oakland. And the local newspapers here have been working very hard to drive a wedge between members of the 99%. And I think it's important to point this out, because when truck drivers who lost a day's pay because Occupy shut down the port attack the Occupy movement, it's exactly what the Koch brothers are hoping for. They're sitting in their corporate suites smoking cigars and saying, yeah, look at those little people fighting each other.
Exactly. That's right. This is the name of the game, you know, to have the Occupy movement fighting over tactics. It's also to create dissension between the Occupy movement and the public. You know, and the public has been broadly supportive of Occupy, but we know, I mean, this was exposed on Democracy Now! And maybe other sources as well, that, you know, that PR firms were selling public relations campaigns to purposefully try to change the public perception of the Occupy movement and to characterize it as, you know, as troublemakers, as, you know, as outlaws, as a public health threat. And these were the talking points that were basically sold to mayors around the country. You know, when they all went after their Occupy sites, they were all reading from the same playbook and all saying that they were causing public health problems, when in fact many of them were dealing with the public health problems that were unattended, you know, by our politics as currently constituted. You know, the vast numbers of people who don't have homes, the homeless who don't have a safe place to crash for the night, the mentally ill, drug abuse problems, and so on. I mean, there were amazing systems that were set up in many of the Occupy sites in California, certainly in Boston, where they had, you know, they had really state-of-the-art, and in New York as well, they had state-of-the-art healthcare supports for the most critical kinds of public health and mental health problems that the powers that be are just flagrantly neglecting. So, yes, absolutely. You know, divide and conquer is the name of the game, and that's why, you know, in our campaign, we're really putting out a very different message that, you know, that people can unify behind, that brings us together around basic principles of democracy, justice, peace, the sustainable future that we all urgently need and, you know, can have. It is within our reach if we demand it.
We're talking with Jill Stein, candidate for president in the Green Party, and you can visit her website at jillstein.org. Dr. Stein, tell us quickly, if you would, what the Green Party nominating process is. You don't have to name other candidates, but tell us how big the field is. And what is the process here to naming a candidate for the primary elections this year?
Great. So there are a handful of other candidates, but most of them, well, I should say none of them, have active campaigns. So our campaign is pretty much the one campaign that you know, is fully staffed up, that has hundreds of volunteers, that has all the trappings of a full-powered campaign.
And are you on the ballot?
We currently have the ballot status in about 17 states, and we hope to have 42 to 46 states before we're done. We have active Green parties in many states in addition to the 17 where we have the ballot, and other states where we have dormant parties, because it's been hard fighting the system, but suddenly history has caught up to us now, and suddenly a lot of our dormant parties are reactivating. So we do expect to be on the ballot in most states. We are having primaries in some of those states. That is, you know, primaries where Greens will come out and vote. And in those states that do not have primaries, the parties will be holding state conventions. And then we will be having a national nominating convention in July.
And I'd like to urge our listeners to check the regulations in your state, because some states have open primaries where even if you're a registered Democrat, you could vote in the Green Party primary. Others require you to re-register with a deadline of 15, sometimes 30 days before the primary election. And we know that Republican legislatures and governors have been trying to limit access to the ballot. And so there may have been changes in regulations if you're in a red state. And I encourage you to scope that out early so that you don't get caught behind a deadline and be left without an option when you go to the polls. Dr. Stein, next I'd like to turn to critical issues that the Green Party stands for and champions, and that President Obama has failed miserably on. He said that climate change was going to be the top priority of his administration. And now he cannot even bring himself to utter the words climate and change strung together. He will go as far as talking about energy independence, but that's a very different issue. And the Durban Conference, the United States once again basically just pushed it out, pushed the proverbial kick the can down the road. And, you know, we're basically saying that until China and developing nations agree to the same terms, that we're not going to do anything. And we also have the increasing influence of the resource extractors and their phony think tanks. The Competitive Enterprise Institute in Washington is funded by ExxonMobil and the other big oil companies. And it's really shameful to see the way the media has responded in the last few years. But the president's cave-in on climate change has been matched by a media narrative that gives equal weight to the deniers, who are all paid prostitutes. I mean, that's the right word to describe them.
Mm-hmm. I agree completely. And the role of the media is not to take, you know, the extremes of the political discourse and just, you know, triangulate and find the halfway point. You know, the role of the media should be to sort fact from fiction to start with, you know, and it's outrageous that, as you say, a handful of, you know, paid political spokespeople on behalf of the fossil fuel industry are being balanced against, you know, virtually 99.9% of climate scientists and national associations of science that all support, you know, climate change and the science of climate change, which really demands urgent, principled, substantive action now. Even with that disinformation campaign, still the American public basically gets it, not as much as they would without the disinformation campaign. But even so, about 70% of the American public, according to a recent Pew study, you know, really supports that that we be taking concrete, positive action on climate change, and we're not. I mean, we've basically given up the ship, and we've not only given it up, we've actually sabotaged it. The U.S. was really the main blockade in developing real climate policy, and in fact, what came out of Durban was not only no action, but a guarantee that nothing will happen before 2020. It's absolutely staggering, because what the science currently says is that, and I'll translate this in a minute, and this is being stated by the International Energy Association. That's a climate group that was started by Henry Kissinger in the 70s. I should say it's an energy group, not strictly a climate group. It's an energy group. So this is hardly like a left-leaning or radical energy group. And what they're saying is that right now we are on track, and this is what most scientists are saying, we're on track for at least 2 degrees centigrade of warming by the end of the century. 2 degrees, just to translate, means maybe we're going to survive. I mean, this is what the debate is about, whether 2 degrees warming is something that the climate can stabilize at, or do we enter into this cycle of escalating heat. We're not sure that life support systems are going to survive 2 degrees warming. And actually, I should back up here. What the Kissinger group, in fact, says is that we're not within 2 degrees at all. What we're actually headed for right now is 5 degrees, way above the threshold where the debate exists about whether or not we can survive. So we are headed right now for really scary territory. The only way we can prevent that from happening, from getting into this absolute skyrocketing, pressure cooker of a climate, the only way we prevent that from happening is by taking really concerted action right away, taking really profound, strong climate change prevention right now. And the president has basically taken that off the table and says no way he's going to do anything in that direction for at least the next 8 years. And that is basically a death sentence to our children and perhaps to us as well, if one has any regard here for the science at all.
And the New Yorker, I believe it was reporter Ryan Lizza, who wrote a powerful piece about what happened in 2009 as three members of the Senate were trying to cobble together some sort of a reasonable and, unfortunately, market-based approach to reducing mm-hmm. carbon emissions. And right. the White House would routinely upstage them or offer concessions before there was any leverage or deal on the table. And it was really disconcerting to see the campaign team that performed rather remarkably in 2008 fumbled so badly on what was supposed to be a signature issue. And we've seen the president cave in on the tailpipe emission standards, just shelve them, and a very modest coal program to reduce mercury and carbon emissions from coal plants is being announced today here on the 21st of December, but it is modest, and still it's being described by its opponents as a war on coal. And it's just amazing to see how this administration has really failed on so many critical issues related to the environment and really the future of humans on the Earth.
Exactly. They gave up, you know, even after they had this enormous mandate from the popular vote, and after, during the time when they still had both houses of Congress. So it's absolutely inexcusable that they threw in the towel even back in 2009. So, yes, I mean, this is just another reason why it's really important, I think, for progressives to find their spine, you know, and go back to their values. Because if you have a democracy in which you cannot bring your values into the voting booth, you have no compass. You know, democracy needs an ethical compass as its guidepost. If you don't bring your values into the voting booth, you know, we're going to keep getting exactly more of what we're getting. While there are small differences, one may argue, between the parties, they both represent sinking ships. As you're pointing out, you know, we do not have a survivable climate here under the Democrats. It's really hardly better at all than it would be under the Republicans. And in fact, if the Republicans were making these same rules, at least there would be a fight about it, and there would be foot dragging, and you know, something would be done. But as it's happening now, there's basically just silence. So if we allow them to talk, that is, the political elite, to talk progressives into muzzling ourselves, we've basically given up the goat here. And, you know, what we need to do in this election is to stand up, whether we are 2% or 52%. The minute we regain our voice, they can no longer ignore us, and we can at least begin to fight our way forward, which is what we must do. We've practiced the politics of silence here, you know, for the past 8 years. The past 8 or 9 years, we've been talked into being silent through this fear campaign. And what we've gotten really demonstrates very clearly that silence is not an effective political strategy. You know, so it's time for us to stand up and regain our voice and to reclaim our democracy in this election and start rebuilding the peaceful, just, green future that really is within our reach if we can begin to take our government back.
And Dr. Stein, as the president was negotiating with himself and giving away things that never led to a deal, he opened up offshore drilling a month before the debacle in the Gulf of Mexico, the biggest pollution event in the history of oil extraction. And he also tried to win Republican votes by agreeing to federal loan guarantees totaling over $30 billion for the construction of new nuclear power plants. And despite the tragic events and dramatic events at Fukushima, that hasn't changed a bit. And this, you know, is a president who wanted to appeal to Greens and progressives, and he has done the bidding of industries, even while taking incoming fire from Republicans and corporatists about how he doesn't do enough.
I couldn't agree with you more. It's like, how many times does Barack Obama need to say no, you know, to your health, your environment, your option for education, for a survivable future? How many times does he need to basically stab you in the back, you know, before you actually stand up and start to pull us back from the brink before it becomes too late to do so? So, I couldn't agree with you more. There's every reason for people to stand up. And I would add to your list of the long litany of betrayals by the president on the environment, I would add to that, coal and the accountability of coal companies. Massey Coal just recently basically got off with a slap of the hand for fraud and abuse that led to the deaths, the tragic deaths of 29 miners. And, basically they're being let off with relatively small fines and without criminal prosecutions by the Federal Justice Department. And it's really just inexcusable. It's yet another reason why, Barack Obama should not be protected by the progressive community, why the progressive community really needs to get beyond this fear campaign and to actually, to realize that the politics of fear has brought us everything that we were afraid of, from the expanding war to the crashing economy, the bailouts, the layoffs, the offshoring, the expanding war, you name it. The politics of fear has won them all for us. If we're going to start regaining our future back, we've got to stand up and start with our democracy, and that begins with our voices.
Dr. Stein, I'd like to close by coming back to a point that you made when we started. The president claims his health care reforms as a signature accomplishment. And while I don't want to feed Republican talking points and those who want to dismantle Obamacare simply for political reasons, the big lie out there that is embraced by the Republicans and exploited by them is that those who oppose so-called Obamacare all are conservative Republicans who don't want to see every American covered with health care insurance. But when those polls were taken a year and a half ago, it was very clear that a majority of those who said they opposed the president's health care bill opposed it because it didn't go far enough, because it didn't rein in the corporate interests, because it didn't do anything to reduce spiraling health care costs. And even though on paper it guarantees coverage, if you can't afford it, that guarantee is meaningless. And so I am very clearly a Medicare for all, single-payer, universal health care advocate. Do we have any remote chance of achieving that in my lifetime? And I'll just clue you in, I'm a little younger than you are.
I should think so. I mean, to my mind, that is inseparable from the question, do we have any remote chance of avoiding a police state? You know, do we have any chance remotely of avoiding a climate that goes into meltdown? Do we have any chance of having a higher education that our students can afford without becoming indentured servants? You know, do we have any chance of having an economy that can survive, you know, the onslaught of Wall Street and corporate America? You know, it's like, do we have any chance on all fronts? And I think when you put them together, it creates an awful lot of conviction, a very broad coalition. It gets us to critical mass, and it creates a really impassioned alliance of good-hearted Americans that are fighting for the basic things that we need to have a peaceful, just, green future. And it's not like we can only get away with just one piece of it, because it's going to take all of us working together, I think, to break through the political logjam. And fundamentally, this is a question of whether we can take our democracy back and get it working for us. To my mind, everything depends on that, and it depends on it, you know, so much that I think it's fair to say our children's lives are going to depend on that, and there's a good chance that our lives are going to depend on that. So, you know, to my mind, it's not something we should leave to chance. It's not something we should leave to the forces of corporate America to decide with their public relations, televised, soundbite campaigns. This is every reason, you know, for us to jump in both feet, full speed ahead, and to begin taking our democracy back in this election. And whether we make a complete breakthrough and whether we get the plurality, it's going to be at least a three-way and maybe a four-way race, whether we get the plurality or whether we simply begin to register on the scale, you know, we begin to build a base around which we continue to organize and around which we can continue to educate the public and build support. Because you know what? The public already supports what only we are talking about. None of the other campaigns are. So we have every reason to build a very strong and powerful, unstoppable force for democracy in this election. And I would just, again, encourage people to go to my website, jillstein.org, to find out more and to become that engine that is going to drive us to the peaceful, just future we deserve.
Well, Dr. Stein, thank you for joining us, and I've really enjoyed talking with you. And I more appreciate that you're giving progressives a choice in many states where you will be on the ballot. And I think a vote for Jill Stein would send a very powerful message to the president and his administration that they have miscalculated and taken advantage of or tried to wedge in the progressive base that was responsible for his surge in the primaries back in 2008. And I hope that that message will be sent, and I hope that people will respond to this interview. Go to your website and let their friends know that there is a choice, and that you are an important vehicle, if you don't mind being objectified that way, for expressing the discontent that so many of us feel.
Very good. I couldn't agree with you more. The solution to a rapidly sinking ship is not a ship that's going down slightly less rapidly. You know, we need a new vehicle, a politics of integrity, to move us forward to the future we deserve.
Dr. Stein, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Peter. You take care.
And now Gary Chu, the official film reviewer of the Peter B. Collins Show, joins us to recap four films that are in the theaters for your holiday viewing. Take it away, Mr. Chu.
Glut time now at the old movie house, people. Must speak tersely. War Horse, Steven Spielberg's visual stunner about World War I, tells of a smart horse in that awful conflict. It's a striking equine, taking the movie's lead, that wins the hearts and minds of friend and foe after bonding as a foal with a family in rural England. There's no forgetting what you'll see of Spielberg's picture-perfect images. They're so affecting. You'll forget that the story is pretty predictable, although satisfying. It's first-rate family fare. Horse lovers won't be able to rein themselves in watching War Horse. What's novel about a silent film? You get the answer seeing The Artist. It's really an ironic movie, too, if you watch it appreciating the notion that The Artist is something new about something old, about 90 years old. The hero of The Artist is always being told, you ought to be in talkies. He's a matinee idol named George Valentine, played by Jean Dujardin. Why George won't do talkies doesn't come till the end, but before that you've got a curiously clever reflexive film, with old-fashioned subtitles and the actors emoting it all with their eyes and body. Our idol runs into Pepe Miller, played by Berenice Bejot. George's gravitas as a silent film star opens the door for the pretty Pepe to outdo him in the picture biz. Soon Pepe's the darling of talkies. That makes a rough row for George to hoe, even with his loyal mutt always at his side. Uggie, the doggie, steals all his scenes with a plum. Movie hounds will surely get stoked seeing The Artist. Charlize Theron is as good-looking as she is at being a film actor. That's why she pulls off being such a bad guy in the very funny Young Adult directed by Jason Reitman and written by Diablo Cody. Charlize plays a 37-year-old looker called Mavis who's going on 16, even if her face and figure say that Mavis has reached the stage where it's all still beautiful, but the blossoming has stalled. She ghostwrites books about females with thought processes of high school girls. She's impulsive and could be terminally self-absorbed. Mavis heads back to her hometown thinking her old flame Buddy, played by Patrick Wilson, must be going nuts still there. She doesn't have a clue that Buddy is content with his wife and new baby. Even when a former high school classmate named Matt advises Mavis that she ought not bark up Buddy's matrimonial tree, Patton Oswalt gives a really great go doing Matt. Young Adult has lots of Charlize up close and smug as Mavis tries reigniting her mojo romancing Buddy, dissing old friends and family, with Matt plying talk therapy and his maid-in-the-garage booze. Theron gets to gaze at her stunning self in the mirror, applying makeup and donning snazzy duds to set traps for Buddy. Using real people, Young Adult is much like a Roadrunner cartoon, but with a very lovely coyote. Meep meep. With the girl with the dragon tattoo number 2, word is out that James Bond has finally met his match. And it's a girl! This is the American remake of the 2009 Swedish original that was part of the progeny from the terrific trilogy written by Sweden's remarkable author Stieg Larsson. Tattoo's a film that skips along briskly trying to cover a voluminous novel with good action, some of it grisly, with sadism here and there, topped off with girl-girl sex and the old-fashioned kind. I must read the book. Both films have tickled my fancy as to what all else is going on with a Swedish business family known as the Vangers, sort of a Nordic version of the Ewings, but the Vangers are even more eccentric and socially constipated than J.R. and the Texas Oil family of the old Dallas TV series. Like both the Swedish and U.S. versions of the creepily great Let the Right One In, Tattoo dares you not to watch, but you can't help but look at its bizarre investigation into what happened to one of the Vanger daughters 40 years ago. Daniel Craig, as an in-trouble magazine journalist named Mikhail, takes on a petite sidekick, a goth goddess named Lisbeth. Rooney Mara returns in the same role she did so convincingly in Tattoo No. 1. An unerrable phrase emblazoned on a t-shirt Lisbeth wears in one scene suggesting one might not want to mess with her should be taken to heart. Craig plays it a bit more frazzled than 007, but it's still a good reading, and Ms. Mara is surely the coolest female ever to get in front of a Panaflex. It would be an understatement to only say that Lisbeth's attitude is intense. She hates men for what was done to her as a girl, which sets up one thing that turns out really nice about Tattoo. Although a lesbian, Lisbeth, in a phrase, comes across after getting respect and validation from Mikhail, she learns finally that being with a dude isn't half bad. Social network director David Fincher trying for a little tenderness. The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, American style. It's as good as its predecessor, but despite the acclaim and popularity, might best have been left on the page. I'm Gary Chu, down along the fjord.
Well, now that we're down in the valley, let's saddle up Trigger and see if we can reach that peak over there. Happy holidays, everybody.
Happy trails to until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until